Hello and welcome to Patriotic History. Today's date is Friday the 6th of August 2021 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming live tonight at RadioAlbion.com. I would normally have my co-host with me, the Patriarch. Unfortunately, he is stuck on a train somewhere at the moment, but he has managed to send over some of his notes that I can add to the notes that I also have here to get into the show. And just a brief description of what we're doing here. We're hoping to document the starts of the various civilizations around the world and show the earliest empires and show the white people that were involved in that. And we started off with Sumer and the Fertile Crescent. And then we started talking about the Bronze Age, and we realized that in order for there to be bronze, you also needed tin. And of course, in the Fertile Crescent, there is no tin. So we were looking around and there was no tin around that area. And in actual fact, the nearest area with lots and lots of tin was Cornwall. And of course, then we looked into it and we discovered that actually tin mining has been going on in Cornwall for about 3,000 years. And where did they get the idea to do the tin mining and to mix it together with copper to make bronze from? Well, they must have got that from the Fertile Crescent. And we've covered that in the last couple of episodes. And we've also been getting into the connection with Joseph of Arimathea, because there's all this folklore and legends that Joseph of Arimathea was connected to the tin trade. And this week we're going to look some more at Joseph of Arimathea and also some of the folklore that surrounds him, some of the religious ideas that surrounds him. And we had a couple of points that we raised last week that I wanted to get into first. We were talking about various names for mine workings that were connected with Jews. They were called Jews houses, the mine workings were called, and there were Jews leavings, which was bits of tin that were left around. So there was definitely a connection with the whatever the word was in Cornish for Jew. Now, the Jews didn't actually come into Britain until 1066, and there's no evidence that they were here before then. So what we must have been talking about here is people from that part of the world, possibly before it was Judea, possibly before it was actually the Roman province of Judea. And they were probably talking about people that were ethnic Hebrews rather than people that were Judean citizens. And then, of course, with the advent of Christianity and this word Jew that came into common parlance, I should imagine that that's when these terms like Jews houses and Jews leavings, that's when they became known as belonging to the Jews or the word the Jew. So we were trying to find the Cornish word for Jew, and I couldn't actually find one anywhere. However, in Welsh, which is very closely related to Cornish and Breton, the word is Idu. And that's for Jew. The word is Idu, spelled I-D-D-E-W, which to me seems much closer to Idumean, which is the Latin word for Edomite, than Judah, which is the Latin for Judahite. So the word itself seems closer to Edomite than it does to Judah. And Cornish, Breton and Welsh are all very similar languages. If somebody understands Welsh, then they're going to understand Cornish and they're going to understand Breton. And that's because years ago, the ancient Britons, they didn't just have land in Britain. They also had Brittany as well. It might have had Armorica as well. And they basically went over there in about the 4th or the 5th century. There was a big an exodus, basically, from Britain at that time that went over to Brittany. And there are reports of a comet actually hitting the island, which decimated the island. And because the island had been decimated, because so many people had left, there weren't very many Britons here when the Saxons came over. And that's why the Saxons were able to conquer Britain. And there's also a story that the finest of the men also left on a war-making escapade as well. And we'll get into all of these things in detail when we come to actually looking at Britain, because what we're doing at the moment is really just a detour to look at the tin trade. And these are just things that come in at the same time as the tin trade as well, things connected to it. So we cannot actually find a word in Cornish for Jew, but we do have this Welsh word, and it's Idu, which, as I say, is closer to Idumean than it is to Judah. Now, I also found some more information on the word decurio, because we said Joseph of Arimathea was known as a nobilis decurio, and the troop commander was the decurio, and the same name is given in civil life to a town councillor. That comes from Webster, page 147. We have a quote from Scullard here. Decuriones were drawn from the wealthier members of the town, including former magistrates, and were meant to dip into their own pockets for the public good. So obviously wealthy people, obviously important people, something to do with the town council. The Latin word decurion is equated with deacon, a word which describes an officer in a Christian church, and in this context it also denotes a Roman citizen of some standing, because the legends tell us that Joseph of Arimathea, as well as being a part of the Sanhedrin and being very high up in the Judean administration, he was also high up in the Roman administration. And Lawrence Gardner, in The Bloodline of the Holy Grail, proposes that it has the meaning of an overseer of mining estates. And he goes on to suggest that the term originated from Spain, where Phoenician traders were active. And the importance of this word is that it appears so many times. In the Vulgate Bible, Joseph of Arimathea is described as a decurio. In Maelgwn of Llandaff's treatise from about the 4th or the 5th century, he talks about Joseph of Arimathea being a nobilis decurio as well. So we know that's what he was, but does it have this connection with mining estates? Does it have this connection with being a tin trader? Because the Cornish legends tell us that that's what he was. He was a tin trader. That was his connection to Britain. That's why he came to Britain when the Galileans were being persecuted by the Romans and by the Jews straight after Christ's death and resurrection. They were persecuted, so they had to get out of the Roman Empire. And the only civilized place that was outside the Roman Empire was Britain. And this is where all these legends come about that Christianity first came to Britain with Joseph of Arimathea. And this is also why when St. Augustine came to Britain in the 6th century with the Saxons, he discovered that there was already a Christianity in Britain, and it was a different Christianity to the one that he had, which was the Catholic Christianity. And the differences were that the British Christians didn't baptize, and they had Easter on a different date. And this is because Christianity was brought to Britain before St. Paul, because St. Paul had his road to Damascus moment sometime after the Galileans had actually left Jerusalem and left the Roman Empire. So that explains why there was this different form of Christianity in Britain. It was actually the earliest form of Christianity. And that's another subject that we will get into when we look specifically at that area, which is all about the first king to be, or our first king, Lucius, to become Christian, which was around about 170 AD. And Britain became the first nation to actually proclaim themselves Christian. And I've got some notes here from Patriarch in reference to this word Idu. He says, so does it suggest that the Edomites were big merchants in the trade routes? As a people, the Edomites today seem to have disappeared on the surface, but we know with a little more research how these people became synonymous with the Jews of today. If their presence was known back then in the Isles, then perhaps it solidifies the connection. Well, the point is, I mean, the Edomites were traders, but back then they were in Judea. They weren't spread out all around the world. The Hebrews had spread out around the world, and they'd managed to make their way to Britain, and they'd actually been displaced from where they were, and then they were put in Assyria. They became known as the Scythians and the Cimmerians, but the Edomites stayed where they were, and they moved into the land that the Israelites had formerly been living in. And when the remnant of the tribe of Judah came back from Babylon, which is only about 1% of the Israelite population, because the remnant of Judah was 10% of Judah, and Judah was about 10% of the Israelite population. When they came back to their former land of Israel and Judah, it had been colonized by these Edomites. So they ended up having to first off remove the Edomites from the land, and the Edomites then settled in the land outside, and they had villages there, and then they went to war against them. And when they went to war against them, when they won the war, they said, well, you can either be our slaves, or you can get circumcised and you can follow the same religion as us, and you can be Jews the same as us. Because by that time, this term Jew was actually being used. And Josephus tells us that the first time the word Jew was used was when this remnant of the tribe of Judah came back into their former land and blended with this people called the Edomites, who were partially descended from Canaanites. So the Edomites were, that's where they were, that was in Judea. Whereas in Britain, you had the descendants of Brutus, who would have been the ones that set up the mining, because they'd been in Britain. There are two dates for it. The traditional date is the 11th century BC. There's another date that's put forward, which is the 6th century BC. Either one is 6 to 1,000 years before Christ. And you had Brutus and his people in Britain. And I think we talked about it in one of these episodes. Brutus's ancestry goes back to Zarah, Judah. Judah himself had two twin sons, Pharez and Zarah, and the Pharez line stayed in the Holy Land, and the Zarah line disappears before Moses actually left Egypt. So Zarah and his followers left, and then you can trace them in the pagan histories. They went to Troy, they settled Troy, and then when at the fall of Troy, Aeneas left Troy. One of his sons married the daughter of Latinus and started off the Roman Empire. One of his other sons gave birth to Brutus. I think Brutus ended up accidentally killing his father, and he left with his men, and he made his way through Europe, and he picked up a load of Trojans that were actually in Greece that were being held as slaves, and he had a vision on an island that he stopped off at. He had a vision of Diana, and she said, make your way to the White Island, and there you will start a dynasty and an empire, and the sun will never set on the empire, and all this. You can check it out. I'm just sort of recalling this from memory. And then he made his way to Albion, which is what the island was known as at the time, and he was acknowledged as the king, and he split the country up into Cornwall, Logria, Albany and Cambria, and he was the king of the whole country. And it would have been him and it would have been his people that set up these Cornish mines, and they knew their ancestry. They knew their ancestry, and they traded with the Phoenicians. And we were saying last week that the Phoenicians that actually traded with the British miners were not really Phoenicians. They were actually Israelites as well, because the strip, Phoenicia, that strip that's there, that's Syria and Lebanon, at the time this was happening, the Canaanites that had been living there had all been expelled from the land, because Joshua went to war against them. He expelled them from their land. We've got this confirmed in the Tel El Amarna letters, which are from the Canaanites that were living there in the land at that time. And they were begging the Pharaoh in Egypt to come and help them, because Joshua was making war against them. And we're told in the Bible that all these Canaanites were expelled from that land, and two tribes in particular moved in there. I think it was Asher was one of them. And it would have been those people that we then know as the Phoenicians. And they also built Carthage, the city of Carthage. And I think that was named after Dido, which was one of the Israelite princesses. So the time we read about in history, we're told about this great big Phoenician empire. Those people that were in that empire were actually these tribes of Israel. And they were the ones that would have come to Britain to pick up the tin. And they would have been known as Judah, or a name that was associated with that. And I think over the years, that name has become Jew, because as we've lost all this history and we've forgotten all this history, we've just started to refer to everybody from that area as a Jew. So instead of talking about the tribe of Judah, the tribe of Israel, the Danites, the tribe of Asher, we just referred to all of them as Jews. And we didn't distinguish between the tribe of Judah, who had ancestry to Judah, or a Judean citizen who could have ancestry anywhere. All of those people together, we lump them all into under this one name of Jew. So I don't think it was Edomians that were actually coming to Britain at that time. I think it was Israelites. And this Welsh word that actually says Edomian. Remember, the Welsh weren't actually talking about the people that were coming to pick the tin up. They were referring to what they knew as Jews. So I think that word Edu probably came about around about the time that the Edomians had absorbed the tribe of Judah. And also, when we read in Flavius Josephus' works, he tells us that the actual ethnic Judahites were really not happy about this, and they mocked Herod for his ignoble heritage. Some of them were prepared to go to their death rather than to acknowledge that Herod was part of their same tribe. And you also had the Essenes, who kept to the Old Testament law, and they kept to the commandment not to take strange wives. And they separated themselves from the Pharisees and the Sadducees. They were essentially the nationalists of the time, and they were against the Edomians as well. So this politics was sort of known about around about the time of Christ, and I guess the Britons would have known about it then as well at that time. But as we lost this knowledge, as we forgot this knowledge, those references to the Israelite tribes coming over to pick up the tin just got absorbed by this word Jew, which we just use for everything. And I've gone halfway through the show talking about this, and I really wanted to get into about the tin, and I've ended up going off onto one of my favourite subjects, which is the Israelites. So getting back to what we have here about the tin and the tin trade, the Encyclopaedia Britannica 1943 edition notes that the wealth of Cornwall lies not so much in the soil as underground and in the surrounding sea, hence the favourite Cornish toast, fish, tin and copper. The tin of Cornwall has been known and worked from the Bronze Age, as we've shown. By ancient charters, the tinners were exempt from all jurisdiction, save in cases affecting land, life and limb, other than that of the stannary courts, and peculiar laws were enacted in the stannary parliaments. A tax on the tin after smelting was paid to the earls and the dukes of Cornwall. And we talked about the stannary courts in the last episode, and how tin was worth so much money back then, because it was essential in order to keep the Bronze Age going. So Cornwall was a very important place, and anybody that could actually mine the tin and that could smelt the tin and get the impurities out from it was a very important person. They were worth a lot to the nation. So what does all of this have to do with Joseph of Arimathea? Well, this, along with the traditions of a Jewish presence in Cornwall, or as we've said, a Phoenician presence or an Israelite presence, there are traditions of Joseph having visited the area in the course of his mining business. Fragments of poems and miners' songs handed down through the centuries make frequent reference to him. One refrain runs, "Joseph was a tin man, Joseph was in the tin trade," and that's from Cornwall by S. Baring Gould. In the Guide to Penzance, Land's End and the Scilly Isles, the author states that there is a traditional story that Joseph of Arimathea was connected with Marazion, which is a small seaport of Cornwall, 2 miles east of Penzance, when he and other, and it says Jews, traded with the ancient tin miners of Cornwall. And that's from the 5th edition, Ward, Locke and Co. London. Of course, it wasn't Jews that were actually trading here at this time. It was Phoenicians, and these Phoenicians were Israelites. The Jews were in Jerusalem, and they were involved in having a revolution against the Romans. And Joseph was supposedly Jesus's uncle, and that's where we get this legend that Jesus himself actually walked on the soil of Britain in the famous hymn Jerusalem. And that's actually what it is referring to. And in Cornwall, they have these crosses that show like a child in a tunic. So it's basically showing that Jesus as a child, but on the cross as well. And that's because the legend tells us that he came to here when he was a child with his uncle Joseph. And then after the resurrection, Joseph supposedly took Jesus's mother and took her to Britain. And this is recorded that they first went to France. And this hymn that we have, "I saw three ships come sailing in," that's referring to it, these three ships that came in. And when Joseph got here with Mary, the king gave him 12 hides of land at Glastonbury. And those 12 hides of land are mentioned in the Doomsday Book, which William the Conqueror caused to be written and researched when he actually came into Britain. And that refers to these 12 hides of land that never paid tax. And Joseph supposedly then built the Domus Dei, which was the first church, proper built church above ground, which was Glastonbury Church, Glastonbury Abbey. Is it really so incredible that Joseph of Arimathea had commercial interests in the British Isles, the Cassiterides, or the Tin Islands of the ancient world? After all, Seneca, the Roman philosopher, dramatist, and statesman who was appointed tutor to Nero and had great influence with the emperor, amassed great wealth as a result of his business interests and investments in Britain. Unfortunately, Seneca obtained his vast fortune by trickery and promoting usurious loans to the British. Joseph, on the other hand, was impeccably honest in all his business transactions. Virtually all the early records and traditions concerning Joseph associate him with the mining activities of Cornwall and the Mendips Hills of Somerset. And Seneca, I think we talked about in Greatest Britons, we did an episode on Boadicea, and that mentions that Seneca, through usury, he ended up getting the tribe that Boadicea was a part of in debt to them, and they basically took over, him and the Romans, took over all the public buildings, the public offices, and there was an uprising against them that was led by Boadicea. So this is all sort of talking about this same time, and there are so many references to Joseph, so many old songs about him, especially linked with the tin trade. You have to say, well, there's no smoke without fire. There must have been a connection there. And as I pointed out last week, the earliest connection is in the charter of Maelgwyn of Llandaff, which is from the 4th or the 5th century, that mentions him and tells you where he's actually buried. And some people think, well, the main narrative, the mainstream narrative, is that he was buried in Glastonbury Abbey, and that's what Maelgwyn of Llandaff is referring to. But there are other researchers that say that it's not Glastonbury Abbey, it's actually a church in Wales that is being referred to there. So either way, Joseph was in Britain. It's just that there are two separate strands of research saying where it is he was actually buried. And Patriarch says it sounds a bit far-fetched to connect key characters of the Bible in the Levant to the British Isles. Well, it does, but there's so much evidence for it. You have, as I say, this goes back to the 4th or the 5th century. You have all these old poems. You have places that are named after him. You have the Jesus and Mary stone, a famous stone at Glastonbury. And these traditions go back well over 1,000 years. And he says, just so people know, Joseph was the man responsible for the burial of Christ and was also a follower. I wonder if he helped in any way to promote the Gospels. Also, do we know how he died? Well, apparently this is how Christianity came to Britain, was through Joseph. And he came with 11 apostles of his own, 11 disciples with him that he actually brought with him. I think one of them might have been Lazarus. I'll have to check on that for the next episode. I know that he did have Lazarus with him when he was in France, but whether Lazarus actually also came to Britain as well, I'm not sure. There was also somebody called Aristobulus. And there's also a connection with Rufus Pudens. There are two people that are referred to in the book of Timothy, I believe it is. And one of those was actually the daughter of King Caradoc, or King Caractacus. And she married a friend of St. Paul's. And St. Paul actually stayed in the Palatium Britannicum in Rome, which was the palace where Caradoc or Caractacus was staying, because he was held hostage. He basically fought a really brave and courageous war against the Romans for about 10 years, and the Romans couldn't defeat him. And one of the tribe that Boadicea was a part of ended up drugging him and then binding him up in chains and handing him to the Romans. And the Romans took him to Rome and they wanted to make an example of him. And he basically gave a very famous speech where he says, you know, you great Romans, you've defeated everybody in battle. Everybody knows how fearsome you are. Would you not like to go down in history with people knowing how merciful you are as well? And I'm an honorable fighter. I've given you a good fight for the last 10 years. How about you have mercy on me? And the Caesar had mercy on him. And the agreement was that if he stayed in Rome in his Palatium Britannicum, he would still be able to get his taxes from Britain. But his tribe in Britain, I think it was the Silurian tribe, they were not allowed to continue fighting against Rome. And there was some peace there. And when he had this Palatium Britannicum, that's where Paul stayed when he was in Rome. And the Palatium Britannicum then became known as St. Pudentiana and then the Hospitalum Apostolorum, meaning the place where the apostles stayed. And that was the first church that there was in Rome. So there's this connection there. And then you've got Joseph of Arimathea comes to Britain, and then the descendants of Caractacus, or one of these descendants, he converts to Christianity. And he's also welcomed by the Druids, because Druidry was very, very close to Christianity. So he's conversing with them and having his philosophical discussions with the Druids. And there was a Christian community there. And eventually there were that many people that had converted to Christianity that King Lucius in 170 AD, he announced that from then on the nation would be Christian. And the Welsh triads, which tell us all about the laws that we actually had back then, which come down from Molmutius, who was a king in about the 4th century, who wrote a law code for us. One of those laws was that you could only change the religion of the country by the unanimous vote. There were three things that you could only change by a unanimous vote, and one of them was the religion of the country. So the very fact that we changed from Druidry to Christianity shows that it was a unanimous decision, and there was no conflict between the Druids and the Christians. And the Druids, apparently they had the same name for God. It was Yesu was the name of their God. And as we mentioned last week, they had sacrifices of animals, which is what the Hebrews used to do. They wore these white clothes, the same as the Hebrews. There were lots of connections with it, because if you think the British were descended from these Hebrews, but they hadn't actually been following these Hebrew laws for 1500 years, then you would imagine that there would still be some ideas that were still there. The idea that you ended up living on after death as well is one of them. And Caesar says that's the reason why the British were such fierce fighters, is because they believed that the soul continued on after death. So this all ties in with how we had Christianity here so early. And yes, Joseph of Arimathea did help in promoting the Gospels. Do we know how he died? Well, we're told by Maelgwn of Llandaff that he did die, and he tells us where he was buried. Then we know that in the 10th and the 11th century, it was just accepted that he was buried in Glastonbury. But we also know that when the Normans came over, they tried to change some of our myths and some of our history to make it reflect them. Edward Longshanks, went to North Wales, and he sort of grafted himself onto the Arthur mythos. I mean, he probably was descended from Arthur in some way, because all the monarchs are actually related and go back to, as I said, this Zara, this descendant of Judah. That's where this monarchy came from in Europe. But he went to North Wales, and he also revived a story of Maximentius, the Roman emperor, who came to Wales because he saw a beautiful woman in his dream, and he was told that she was in Wales, and he came to Wales to find this beautiful woman in his dream, and it was the daughter of King Cole, and he married her, and she became Empress Helena, and she gave birth to Constantine, who was a British prince, and he then went to Rome and became the emperor of Rome, which is why Rome became Christian, because Constantine had been brought up as a Christian in Britain. And Edward the First revived this story, and he said that this took place in Carnarvon, and then he built his castle in Carnarvon. And what he was basically saying is, well, the Romans had their castle, and it was here in Carnarvon, and that's where Caesar ruled the whole of the Roman Empire from there, and he also brought Roman soil over. And now I've built my castle here in North Wales as well. And just like Caesar was ruling Rome and everywhere from there, because it was a very important part and Britain was then a part of the Roman Empire, I am now ruling over Wales, England and Scotland. And this is my castle here because it's a very important part. And I'm redoing what the Caesar did centuries before. So he was trying to give himself legitimacy, basically, by building that castle there. And also that was when we first got the Prince of Wales that was born there. His son, Edward II, I think, was born in that castle. And each of the firstborn sons of the royal family since then has been known as the Prince of Wales, which goes back to his son being born in that castle. And I forget how we ended up onto that as well, but that's another favourite subject of mine. Edward Longshanks. But you can see all these histories are all tied in together, basically. And people will try to use the earlier history to give themselves legitimacy today. So Edward Longshanks was using the Welsh history, the Brittonic history, to give himself legitimacy and his rulership legitimacy in the 12th century, because of course the Britons had been displaced by the Saxons when the Saxons came over, and the Saxons really didn't want to acknowledge the Britons' history. It's like when you look at Bede's History of the Anglo-Saxons, it tries to cover up just how civilized and advanced the Britons were. He wants to try and make them out to be backward savages, basically, but he has to admit that they had Christianity before them, and they had bishops here, and Caesar tells us that they had universities here and all sorts. So the Saxons, rather than trying to graft themselves onto the British history, they tried to pretend that British history wasn't there. And then when the Normans came over, they were quite happy to graft themselves onto that British history and claim, well, we were also related to these kings that were descended from Brutus, and that gives us legitimacy. And in actual fact, when the Tudor kings came in, they were directly related to the former Welsh kings. So it was, in effect, the line of Brutus, a more direct line of Brutus that was actually on the throne. And of course, all that was foretold to Brutus, that his empire or his kingly line would continue and would stretch out across the world. Getting back to Joseph of Arimathea here. In 1916, Mr. H. Jenner, FSH Chief Bard of the Gorzed, wrote twice at least to the Western Morning News about the oral tradition that Joseph visited Cornwall. He also contributed a masterly article on the subject of St. Joseph of Arimathea in the summer 1916 edition of Pax, the organ of the Benedictines, in which he points out the difficulty of finding an adequate reason why Joseph should be singled out in tradition as the Apostle of Britain, unless it happened to be the literal and actual truth. He then goes on to tell how a certain invocation among tin workers who say quietly to themselves, "Joseph was in the tin trade," may afford some ground for the legend. He quotes a Mr. Hamilton, through Mr. Hallam, a master at Harrow, as having heard from the foreman of these workers the following explanation of the invocation. "One of these traditions of the metal workers is that Joseph of Arimathea, the rich man of the Gospels, made his money in the tin trade between Phoenicia and Cornwall." So he's saying there is so much evidence here to show this, and it is all about one single apostle. I mean, it's not telling us that there were any other apostles here. It's not saying it was Lazarus. It's not saying it was Peter. It's not saying it was Paul. All of them say that it was St. Joseph. And the fact that there is so much evidence for that and concentrating on just one man, it does seem likely that there is some truth to it. And Patriarch says, so this evidence directly connects these isles to the Levant region and to Rome much earlier than publicly aware. Yes, it does. And, you know, you can see it in Bede's History of the Anglo-Saxons, because he tells us that the country was Christian, that the Welsh that were here before the Saxons, they were Christian and they had bishops. And you can look in the church histories as well, and there are quite a few mentions in the church history that all the other churches have to yield to Britain in terms of antiquity. Rome didn't become Christian until, I think, the 3rd or the 4th century. There was a church there, obviously, which was the church which was the palace of the British king Caractacus. There was a church there, but Rome itself wasn't actually Christian until about the 3rd or the 4th century. And there was a church in Britain, obviously, Glastonbury, the one that Joseph of Arimathea started, but the king of Britain, King Lucius, he didn't actually make the nation Christian until 170 AD. And there are other references to that as well, and there's one Roman Catholic reference that tries to say that King Lucius wrote to Rome to ask them to make him Christian and to explain something, but of course Lucius was there in 170 AD, and Rome wasn't the centre of Christianity until about the 3rd or the 4th century, so he wouldn't have been writing to Rome to get that information from them. Of course, once Constantine had actually made Christianity the religion of the Roman Empire, he also converted Constantinople into his city, and Constantinople became the centre that we had contact with. We would go to Constantinople to decide issues to do with the church, to understand issues to do with law. They were the final arbitrator in things. And we also had some fantastic saints around this time. I did a series on the Celtic saints with Florin Gaia that if people are interested they might want to check out. I'll just have a little look here and see where Patriarch is. Looks like he is still stuck on the train. He says, this surely helps to evaluate the earliest settlers. Perhaps it may be worth looking at this topic in more detail. Well, we will go into this topic in great detail when we look at Britain in this time. As I say, this is just really a detour into the tin mining, because the tin mining was needed for the Bronze Age in the Fertile Crescent, and also about Joseph of Arimathea, because he is so connected to the tin mining. Now, there is another legend to do with Joseph of Arimathea. When Joseph arrived at Glastonbury across the flooded Somerset levels by boat, he is said to have struck the ground on Wirial Hill with his staff, at which spot a holy thorn immediately flowered. Thus the mystery of the Glastonbury hawthorn is apparently explained. One of very few places where it occurs, this particular hawthorn is a naturally occurring genetic mutation, which differs from the common hawthorn in that it flowers twice a year, once in the spring and once on or around Christmas Day. And this is quite amazing, because it does literally flower on Christmas Day, just for a day. This second flowering over Christmas is seen as a miracle, marking the arrival of Christianity in Britain. Traditionally, the hawthorn is a pagan symbol of fertility that has associations with the May Day and the Green Man celebrations in Britain. Thus, the idea of a new blossom coinciding with the festivities around Christ's birth holds profound significance, especially with it being at the site of the supposed first church ever built, the Domus Dei. And I wonder how many people have actually heard of the Holy Thorn or the Glastonbury Thorn. Everybody knows about the Glastonbury Festival, which is really just a temple of hedonism today and paganism. But originally it was the centre of Christianity in this island. And this hawthorn there, this holy thorn, supposedly just sprouted out of Joseph's staff when he put it in the ground. I think the earliest references to it are about the 10th or the 11th century, something like that. So I don't know how long this goes back to. I don't think it really proves that Joseph was here, but it shows us that this legend of him being here has been around for a long time. And it may have been that this thorn was brought back from the Crusades as well, because a lot of these stories came back with the Crusaders after they went to the Holy Land. Well, crowds would gather every Christmas day to witness the holy flowering, but when Britain adopted the Gregorian calendar in 1752 to bring it in line with the rest of Europe, Christmas fell 11 days earlier, meaning that much to the consternation of those who congregated on Christmas Day, no flowers appeared. However, when they returned on the 5th of January, which is the Orthodox date for Christmas, the tree was seen to flower once more, right on cue. So that tends to say that it's the Eastern Orthodox Church that actually have the right date of Christmas, if you're going to go by the miracle here of the Holy Thorn. But the Holy Thorn's legend has not always been appreciated. In the 1640s, during the English Civil War, the original tree was cut down and burned by Cromwell's troops, who condemned it as a relic of superstition. Even then, it was recorded that the man who swung his axe at the tree was blinded in one eye by its thorns. A new tree was planted on Wirral Hill in 1951 on the original site, and in 1965 the Queen erected a wooden cross at Glastonbury with this inscription: "The cross, the symbol of our faith, the gift of Queen Elizabeth II, marks a Christian sanctuary so ancient that only legend can record its origin." And I'll just stop there. I mean, it's tragic what has gone on in our country. When you think of Cromwell's troops just destroying everything in the 1640s, destroying this thorn, you think of the Protestants that smashed down the abbeys. I mean, they were the ones that actually destroyed Glastonbury Abbey during the Reformation. They just smashed it all up. They looted everything so that they could get the give the wealth to Henry VIII. And this idea that he wanted to split with the church so that he could divorce and marry again. It wasn't just that. They wanted the money from the church as well, and his lords wanted the money. And according to Dr. E. Michael Jones, you know, there were genuine grievances on the continent within the Catholic Church. There were grievances with them, with things such as indulgences, but none of that was happening in Britain. None of that at all. There was no excuse for really what went on in the Reformation and the destruction of the monasteries. And I went to look at a church the other day, and thankfully it had missed much of this destruction. I'm not quite sure how, but the sculptures there are just amazing, and they go back 800 years, 900 years. You get a real feel of the faces of the people that were around back then, and the mythology and the folklore that they had. And all the churches used to be like that, and they used to have paintings and frescoes on the inside. And these Protestants, these Puritans, they got rid of all that. They smashed it all down. Instead of making the church a place of glory for the glorification of God, they wanted to make it really bare and with no imagery in it and nothing beautiful in it. They just wanted to deny themselves the pleasure, as if they were going into church for their own pleasure, which they shouldn't do. So they thought, well, we'll get rid of all the nice things in it. But those nice things were put in there for the glory of God, not for the glory of man. Such a shame that they destroyed so much of our heritage, but they also destroyed the holy thorn. A flowering sprig also used to traditionally be cut by the Glastonbury School's children, and it appeared on the Queen's breakfast table at Christmas. And that was the flowering sprig was taken from there after this new version was actually put on the tree. It was a new version of the old version, because lots of cuttings had actually been taken from this holy thorn. So when Cromwell destroyed the holy thorn, there were others that actually had cuttings of it and had propagated it, and they kept it going. So they were able to plant it again in 1951. But the replacement tree had its branches cut off by vandals in 2010, and its subsequent replacement sapling was further vandalized in 2012. And in 2019, the landowner removed the remains entirely. And that's really sad. I mean, who would want to destroy a holy thorn bush like this? And it used to have all these ribbons tied to it, which were representative of people's prayers, and pilgrims would travel to it and they'd tie these ribbons to it. and somebody went up there with a chainsaw and cut the trees off. I can remember this happening in 2010 and just being aghast that somebody could do something so sacrilegious, so blasphemous. You know, just somebody must really hate the British people and really hate Christianity to do something like that and destroy a landmark like that, a religious landmark. Well, the original tree has been propagated several times from cuttings, with one tree grown at Glastonbury Abbey and another in the churchyard of the Church of St. John. The original Glastonbury thorn was cut down and burned as a relic of superstition during the English Civil War, and the one planted on Wirral Hill in 1951 to replace it had its branches cut off in 2010. And I say there's, you know, somebody must really hate the country to cut it down, but we cut it down ourselves, didn't we, during the Civil War. I guess people can, you know, they can be tricked into doing the most stupid things sometimes. Obviously, here at Radio Albion, we're trying to get people to not be able to be tricked into doing stupid things. In March 2011, it was reported that a new shoot had appeared on the damaged tree. However, just as these new shoots came up, they would suspiciously disappear a few days or weeks later. And that reminds me of the tales that you hear about in the country of churches when they're being built. And you find this in so many areas. And they'll say that the legend was that every night, all the work that had been done the day before, all the stones would be thrown around and everything would be destroyed, and the devil would have thrown everything there. So as soon as the builders would start building the church that night, the devil would throw the stones down, or they'd have to start again in the morning. And it just reminds me of that sort of every couple of days, a new shoot springs out from the thorn bush, and then at night, somehow, it disappears. I mean, perhaps it was somebody actually cutting the shoots off so that they could propagate them and use them as cuttings. But on the 1st of April 2012, a sapling grafted from a descendant of the pre-1951 specimen was planted by the landowners working with Glastonbury Conservation Society and consecrated. But it was snapped in half and irreparably damaged 16 days later. And as I said, finally, in May 2019, the tree was entirely removed by the landowner. Many have tried to grow the Glastonbury thorn from seed and direct cuttings, but in the later part of the 20th century, all attempts reverted back to the normal hawthorn type, flowering only in the spring. Now, this is interesting. You know, it's like we've turned our backs on God, we've turned our backs on our traditions, and now our miracle thornbush no longer produces the miracle. It no longer produces the flowers at Christmas. It just produces the flowers in the spring. The story of the Glastonbury thorn doesn't end there, though. And perhaps here we can find out why it ceased to flower at Christmas. Since hawthorn is commonly propagated from cuttings or graftings, there are arguably several surviving examples that can be traced back to the original tree. It is believed that the monks at Glastonbury Abbey regularly took cuttings, while in the History and Antiquities of Glastonbury by Charles Aston in 1722, it is stated, "There is a person about Glastonbury who has a nursery of them, who Mr. Pascal tells us, he is informed, sells them for a crown apiece, or as he can get." A hawthorn in the grounds of Glastonbury Church, as well as the Church of St. John, were both said to be graftings of holy thorn cuttings onto the roots of blackthorn stock, and further cuttings have been exported as far afield as New Zealand, Australia, the USA, and Canada. And I think that's where the problem is. Instead of this being grafted onto another one of the original hawthorn stock, it's been grafted onto blackthorn stock. So you've got the holy thorn, and it's been grafted, instead of being grafted onto an earlier propagated cutting of the holy thorn, it's been grafted onto blackthorn. And that's the reason why it's no longer flowering twice, because it's no longer the original tree. It's been grafted onto stock from another tree. So it's reflecting what the stock of the other tree will do, which is just flower once a year. So that's the reason why this has happened. It's very sad, though, that this miraculous holy thorn, we don't actually have a version of it that still flowers twice, even though we had all these other cuttings. It must have been where they just started putting it onto the blackthorn. That's what must have caused it. There's one other legend to do with Joseph of Arimathea, and that is the Holy Grail. The Holy Grail was also said to be carried with Joseph into Britain. And this goes back to a poem about King Arthur and a story that was brought back with the Templars from the Holy Land about Joseph being hidden in a cave and being fed by the Grail, which was the cup that Jesus drank from at the Last Supper, which was then used to catch the blood that came out when Longinus speared Christ's body to check that he was dead when on the cross. And there's actually two poems that talk about this, and they're part of the Arthurian Grail romances, because you had the stories about King Arthur, which, as I said, they got popularized by Edward I, and then onto the stories of King Arthur, they grafted on Joseph of Arimathea, and they grafted on the Holy Grail story. So that's where you get this connection between the three of them. And the cup was supposedly brought to Britain, and it forms part of the Arthurian legends that grew many centuries after the actual lives of the two King Arthurs. Because if you're aware of the King Arthur legend, people always say, well, it couldn't possibly happen because he fights against the Romans and he fights against the Saxons. Well, the Saxons were around at the time of the Romans, but what actually happened there is that there were two King Arthurs with a couple of generations apart, and both of them were from Wales. And when Geoffrey of Monmouth wrote his History of the Kings of England, he basically grafted the two King Arthurs together into one person. But there was actually two of these King Arthurs. Lawrence Gardner and other Gnostic types believe that the Grail referred to the bloodline that Jesus came from, being transferred to Britain, which it would have been that bloodline, but through Joseph rather than through Christ having children. And this is what a lot of Gnostics will tell you, that they'll tell you that Joseph came over with Mary and Jesus's children, and none of that is borne out by the old legends. That comes from Freemasonic ideas and Freemasonic understandings. I've looked through those books, and most of them use the Talmud as references for when talking about Jesus. So they'll say that Jesus was fathered by Pandera, the Roman chieftain. They say that he had children, or it may not come from the Talmud. It may come from books that are commentaries upon the Talmud. And a lot of these Freemasonic books will use that, and they'll then use the Gnostic Gospels, which were spurious Gospels that were put out at the same time as the original Gospels, to confuse things. And in those, they talk about Jesus being married to Mary Magdalene. So from this idea that Jesus was married to Mary Magdalene, you get the idea that they had children, and then you get that grafted on to the legends of Joseph and Mary coming over to Britain. And instead of Joseph coming over with Mary, the mother of Christ, Joseph comes over with Mary, Christ's wife, and they and their children, and it's their children are in Britain. And that's basically the pagan Gnostic version of the Holy Grail. And they think that rather than it being the cup that caught the blood, that they claim that is an allegory for Mary's womb, and Mary's womb carried Christ's blood into Britain. And that's basically their version of the Holy Grail story. But there's also Grail myths that have become overlaid with the pagan Cauldron of Plenty. And the pagan Cauldron of Plenty would continue to feed people. It would never run empty. And this poem that talks about Joseph of Arimathea, it says that he was imprisoned in a cave, and all he had with him in this cave was the Grail, the cup that Jesus drank from at the Last Supper that also had Jesus' blood in it from Longinus's spear. And that cup continued to provide food for him for, I forget how many years it was, 12 years or something, while he was locked up in this cave. And then when they opened the cave up, he was still alive. And that was because he had been fed by this grail, which is basically the Cauldron of Plenty story, which is an old pagan myth about this cauldron that never runs empty. And then you get the idea that Joseph of Arimathea brought this grail with him to Britain to give it to King Arthur, who then used that to replenish the land, which does actually tie in with something that did happen, as I was saying, about when the comet hit Britain in about the 4th or the 5th century and devastated everything. The land was a wasteland. So that's where you get this story from, that King Arthur needed to find something to make his land produce food again and fruit again and be able to have harvests, because it was a wasteland. So you get that little bit there of real history, that the land was a wasteland, tied in with this legendary mythic history that it was a magic cup that actually made the land produce flowers again. In actual fact, it was just that the devastation ended. And there are church windows showing Joseph with the grail, and there are sculptures showing the same, but they are all from after the 12th century, when Robert de Boron added these events to Chrétien's grail romance, crossed with Geoffrey of Monmouth's work on King Arthur. So you often see representations of somebody holding a cup or a knight holding a cup, especially in Europe, in the churches there. And it's referring to the grail, and it's referring to this poem, which was really written in the 12th century. It doesn't really go back any further than that. You won't read about Joseph of Arimathea having the grail when you're looking at the earliest mentions of him in the 4th or the 5th century with Malguin, or there's a Life of Mary Magdalene, I think, that was written back then. And that also talks about Joseph of Arimathea, but it doesn't mention the Holy Grail. And finally, we have another comment from Patriarch here. He says, if it's true that the Holy Grail came to Britain or Albion, then it makes me wonder, why Britain? Well, the Holy Grail came to Britain because, as I say, because Joseph came to Britain. Whether he actually brought the cup here, I don't know. There is a legend that there is a wooden cup that supposedly used to heal people, and there's only a tiny little bit of it left, and that's actually somewhere in Wales, and some people think that was the Holy Grail. Or this idea of the Holy Grail, I mean, it may have been Joseph of Arimathea himself. I mean, he may have married somebody within Britain, and then that bloodline would have carried on within Britain. But I don't think that there were kings that claimed that they actually came from Jesus or anything like that. That's Dan Brown sort of stuff, that is. Patriarch says, the royal bloodlines are said to be of the line of Judah, right? The same line that Christ came through. And yes, all the royal bloodlines of Europe, that's where they get their legitimacy from, is going back to Zarah-Judah. Judah was the royal line from the Israelites, and his wife gave birth to twins, and the first twin to put his hand out had a red cord tied around it, and then he pulled his hand back in again, and the first twin that actually came out was Phares. But in actual fact, Zarah was the one that first put his hand out and had the red cord around it. But Phares was the one that was actually made into king. He was the one that fathered the Davidic line, King David and Saul and the rest of them, and down through to Christ. And Zarah, whose symbol was the red cord, he and his followers left Egypt at the time of Moses. And this red cord is where you get the red hand from in Ulster. And you get, I think you get a story of someone taking their hand off and throwing their hand off or something. Wherever you hear about a red cord or a red hand or a scarlet sash, that's what it's referring to. It's referring to this royal symbol of Judah. And that's why when Joshua was going around the walls of Jericho, and they were looked after by a woman in Jericho when the spies went there, and the woman that looked after them, I think her name may have been Rahab or something like that, It says in the Bible she was a harlot, but I don't think she was a harlot. I think that's probably a mistranslation. But she said she would hold a red flag outside of her window so that they knew it was her, so that they didn't destroy her part of the wall. And the reason why it was a red flag is because that was the symbol of Judah. That was the symbol of Zara. And we've gone a little bit over time here, but at least we have finished talking about Joseph of Arimathea, which means next week we can move on to the Indus Valley civilization, which was a franchise from the Sumerian civilization. So thank you very much for listening. I look forward to seeing you all again next week. And of course, I do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.